So we are now recording, and I will jump out of that deck. And I'm going to be leading off the presentation on Google Drive. And then we'll head into the questions that have been sent into the queue and so forth. This is basically a follow-up to some discussion we had about the confusion around using Microsoft OneDrive and how somebody was saving things to OneDrive and didn't even realize it, and then was getting messages from Microsoft saying that they had to pay for extra space or clean up their OneDrive. They didn't know they were using it, didn't know how to do the cleanup, and that I found to be one of the problems with Microsoft OneDrive is they have a tendency to change your default save location to OneDrive, and they don't really tell you, and it might not be real obvious because there's underneath OneDrive, there's documents, pictures, and all of the other standard folders and so forth. So you might think you're saving it locally when you're not. So I thought I'd do a little bit of a presentation here on using Google OneDrive, which is my alternative that I use for cloud storage. So as I said, Microsoft OneDrive can be a problem because Microsoft changes the default save location. You don't realize you're using it, you run out of space, and then Microsoft tries to sell you more space. I've been using Google Drive for probably 10 years or more, and I've been quite happy with it. One of the things that I find really good is you get 15 gigabytes for free. I think OneDrive gives you 2 gigabytes for free or something like that. So among the main players, Google Drive is one of the most expansive in terms of free space. I find it quite easy to set up automatic synchronization between your computer and the cloud, as well as other devices that you might have. And I find it quite easy to share files with others and be able to give them a link to files that I store on Google Drive. So the first thing you need is a Google account and a Gmail address. If you've got that, your Gmail address is actually a Google account already. So if you have a Gmail address, you're good to go. Otherwise, you can go on to accounts.google.com and create one. All you need is an email address. The first thing you want to do is make sure that you verify. Oh, let me just mute all. Hang on a second. Mute all. Yes. Okay, verify that you can see your Google Drive. So after you have your Google account set up, if you go to drive.google.com, it should come up and show you something where, oops, sorry. It should come up showing you something like this that you see on the screen there, where on the left-hand side you have some icons for your folders and your trash and various things like that. And then over on the main panel, you have files that are existing in your Google Drive. Now, when you first set it up, it'll probably be emptier. There might be a sample document that is put there automatically by Google. I'm not sure. So you browse to that, sign in if you're not already signed into Gmail or something like that, or your Google account, then you'll be prompted. You have to sign in. Click on New, and then you can upload files or folders, or you can create brand new folders from the website of things. And then you can, once you upload things, you can right-click on files to download them to your computer. And so that's basically it if you want to use it manually. So it's just cloud storage. You can upload files, download files, organize them into folders and things like that. So if you don't want synchronization to your computer, it's that simple to put files up into the cloud and then get them back down when you need them from any device anywhere in the world that you can log into your Google account. But I find it much more useful to get into synchronization, where it will synchronize a set of folders on your computer with the cloud storage. And so you go and install Google Backup and Sync. And I've got the URL there on how you do it. But if you Google for Google Backup and Sync download, it'll take you to the right place. I'll link it up to your Google account if you are prompted. It was a long time ago I did that. It might be that if you're already logged into your Google account, it might just automatically assume that you want to use that. But if needed, link it to the right account. And then you'll end up with an icon on the system tray down near the clock. And just looks like a cloud with an arrow on it. So that's the icon for Google Backup and Sync. If you click that icon, it'll come up with a little pop-up, and it shows you files that have been synced recently. And at the top line, you actually have a little bit more information. You can see I'm using 6 gigabytes of 19 gigabytes. Every now and then, Google might give you a free upgrade to a few gigabytes if you do a security check on your account or things like that. I've done a few of those, so I'm up to 19 gigabytes free. And then you click the three little dots on the right-hand side, go to the preferences, and then you can see what is going to be actually synced. I'm going to jump to the second one first because that to me is the most important one. Google Drive, sync everything. And this is the default. And if you look over on the right-hand side, you see sync my drive, which is what Google calls their cloud storage that is accessed through the web, is my drive. And what does it sync it to? By default, it's /users/your username/Google Drive. So very easy to find that file that is being, or the folder structure that is being synced. And the default is that it'll sync everything. And I'm currently syncing 3.5 gigabytes. Or you can actually go in and say only sync certain folders underneath that Google Drive structure. When you're installing it, you can actually choose to sync it to a different location if you wanted to keep it off your C drive, for example. If you have a fast SSD, you don't want to waste the space on Google Drive, you could actually install it to a physical drive D or something like that. You do have that choice. You can move it afterwards. It's a little bit more involved if anybody's interested. You can find instructions on the web, but if you email me, I could be happy to send you the instructions on how to move it. If you have multiple computers, if you install backup and sync on all of them, that Google Drive will sync between all of the computers. So you can make a change to any of those files or folders on any of the computers that have backup and sync installed on them and logged in using the same Google account, and the files will automatically get synced within seconds of any changes to all of the other devices. That is really, really cool. I use that on my desktop computer and two laptop computers, and I use it a lot for things like presentations like this. And so I just know that I can edit that file on any computer, and it'll automatically sync it back to the other devices. So I have the most up-to-date files on all my computers. You can also go into My Computer, and you can actually have it sync other folders. So I've highlighted there, choose folder. So if you click on that, you can actually point to some other folder on your computer, and it'll automatically synchronize that folder and all subfolders, anything that's in that structure completely. The one thing that's a bit of a gotcha on that is if you have multiple computers, it will not synchronize other folders between all of the devices. It is only to the computer you're configuring that on and Google Drive on the web. So every computer is treated as a separate entity. They all show up when you go into the web interface, but they won't be synced between the computers. So I just keep everything underneath my Google Drive folder structure. In the settings, it's worth going into that. This is the default. Show warning when you remove items from a shared folder. So if you're sharing something and you go to remove the file, you will actually get a pop-up saying, do you really mean to do this? Because you're going to be removing it from somebody else being able to access it. The second one is important. I think open a backup and sync on system startup so that it's always running on your computer while you're logged in. And so it's looking for changes in those folder structures and doing the synchronization automatically. And then you can have the last one is just showing the status icons. It'll show a little check mark when files have been synchronized. Sharing files is pretty easy. So here I went to my Google Drive. So if you look on at the top, you see C Taylor, Google Drive, and I created a folder called public. And then I put a bunch of folders into that. And a couple folders as well. You see the little green check mark on the files and folders. That's the indication that that file is synchronized currently between my computer and the cloud. And then I picked one file there that I wanted to share. Right-click the file. Go to Google Drive on the pop-up menu. Don't go down to where it shows farther down in there saying... Let me see if I can get this working. Um, where it says share down there, you'll always see that on the pop-up. That's not the one you want. You want to make sure you highlight the Google Drive one. And then choose share. And then there's two ways you can share. You can share it either with individuals or just making it a public link that anybody's got the link can view the file. And so I usually just do it where I just get a link that anybody who happens to have the link can view it. I click that, and then it'll come up, and it'll automatically highlight the actual link that you give. So you can just copy that to the clipboard, send that to anybody, and then they can view it. Now, notice that it says anyone with link can view. You can actually go in and you can modify it so that anybody who has the link can actually modify the file or comment on the file and things like that. But the default for a public link is just to be able to view it. And if you want to no longer share the file, you can actually go in there and you can change it back to restricted, which means that it is not publicly shared. It's just shared with anybody that you've specifically chosen. And this is where you go if you want to share it with specific people. Notice here I put in joeuser@example.com, and I want to share with that particular person, and it won't let me do it because there's no Google account found. The only security model that they have to enforce that I'm sharing it with specific people is if it's a Google account. So if you choose a non-Google account, you're not able to share it. So here's one where I actually shared it with myself, another Google account that I actually have, and so it comes up with it without that, no Google account, and then I can go in and I can choose whether I want that person to be able to just view it, comment on it, or actually edit the file. So pretty easy sharing options that are available through Google Drive. If you are sharing files, I just have a couple of recommendations. I find it's really hard to keep track of items that you've shared. So I would actually suggest that you actually create folders underneath Google Drive, one of them called public, one of them called shared, and then in the public are things that you will share to everyone, just in read-only mode, and then shared are things that you, a folder that you put things if you want to share with specific people. In that case, you might want to give some people edit rights or just view rights, whatever you want. But by having those two folders underneath your Google Drive, it makes it really apparent to you things that you put in there that you know, other people are going to be able to access. So I only share items within those folders, not all my other folders underneath Google Drive. And that's it. So happy to take any questions right now if there are any questions on it, while Alan gets set up and takes over sharing to take us through the rest of the deck.
Yeah, just one note, Chris. You said OneDrive gives you 2 gigabytes for free. It actually gives you 5 gigabytes for free.
Oh, okay, good.
And then 100 gigabytes is $2 a month.
Yeah, and if you happen to have an Office 365 subscription, while that subscription is active, you actually have a terabyte. But I think that's sort of a lock-in thing that I don't really like, because if you decide you don't want to continue subscribing to Office 365, what do you do with all of that files? I presume they don't delete them on you. You just won't be able to add anything to your OneDrive. And so I think it's a bit of a trap to start using a terabyte of space just because you've got an Office 365 subscription. But it is there if you want it.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. You showed us on the manual use of Google Drive there, but how flexible is it to do the automated sharing with Google Drive? Can you set up parameters that only things from certain folders or certain folder trees are automatically saved, or is it pretty much an all or nothing thing?
That's in synchronization?
Yeah.
Yeah, synchronization by default, it will do all of Google Drive structure. And so you can turn off that, but the way I look at it is that anything that I want to be synchronized, I just put under Google Drive. So /users/ctaylor/Google Drive. And if I don't want it synchronized, I just don't put it under there. And so to me, it's a really clean way of doing things where, you know, it's just that folder structure. I just know that whole thing is done. Personally, that's the way I handle it, but you can actually exclude some of the folders underneath there. It's just then a bit of a pain for you to manage that. just personal opinion about the best way. It's not that difficult to manage it yourself and start excluding folders. It's just you have to start remembering what is and what isn't being synchronized.
Yeah, in general, I'm a bit of a privacy freak there. I have an issue with putting a lot of stuff up in the cloud. But on the other hand, it's a great way to share files and other things between your various computers.
Yeah, my personal opinion on sharing our cloud storage is that nothing should get put in the cloud if it's of at all a sensitive nature unless it's encrypted. They don't include any native encryption capabilities, but there are a lot of other tools out there that can allow you to encrypt files. So I do have some sensitive files on there. They are encrypted with AES encryption with 256-bit keys, and so I don't really have any worries about that. And I actually keep that in a folder that is specifically anything in that folder is encrypted stuff. And so I do keep that sort of separation in mind. But I do agree everybody should be concerned about anything sensitive that is being stored off their computer.
There's a question in chat to Chris from Ollie. She says, I have lots of remaining storage on the C drive and use an external hard drive for backup. Why would I want an extra drive? I use Dropbox for sharing large files.
There's nothing wrong with that at all. And in actual fact, Dropbox has a backup application very, very, very similar to the app that that Google provides, Backup and Sync. So you can do exactly the same thing with Dropbox. Dropbox, I think, does limit you to 2 gigabytes. So you are more limited on that. But there's absolutely no reason why, other than space-wise, why Dropbox shouldn't be used in place of Google Drive. Why would you need an extra drive? I think every important file should be in at least 3 places. So live on your system that is being used actively, a local backup that can be accessed quite quickly and easily should you have to, and then something that is off-site, either an external hard drive that is taken off-site or cloud storage or something like that could also be used as your third backup.
Yeah, I think the sharing large files is a good thing. I use Dropbox too, and I actually have 5 gigabytes because Dropbox is like Google Drive. They give you extra space now and again.
Oh, okay. And
it's worthwhile bearing in mind that Google Drive will give you 15 gigabytes for free right off the bat.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. Okay, I think we should plow on. I've spent an awful lot of time on that, so we do have a lot of other material to cover. So take it away, Alan.
You got my title slide?
Yes, we do.
Okay. So the first one is for Chris.
Yeah, okay. This is... it came up, the idea that there was a pop-up somebody was getting about a privacy checkup on Google account, and they wondered whether it was a good thing. We discussed it a little bit, with the overall conclusion being that, yes, that's a good thing. But then somebody pointed out the idea that, well, should you trust a pop-up that comes up on your screen that it actually did come from Google? And fair point. I mean, you shouldn't necessarily trust random pop-ups that come up on your screen. So how do you decide to deal with this? Well, instead of clicking on any pop-up, go to the trusted source. If you know that, you know, Google is wanting to do a privacy checkup, well, probably a good bet that it's your Google account. So if you go to accounts.google.com, sign in using your Google account, and there's a big box there, take the privacy checkup. So just do it that way rather than clicking on some random pop-up that comes up on your screen. And this is a variant of Brian Krebs's rule 1 of 3 for online security. If you didn't go looking for it, don't install it. So if you get a pop-up, you didn't go there looking for that particular pop-up, don't click on the pop-up. That's your safest thing to do when you're online. So just go to the trusted source manually.
Okay, I have a brief follow-up about Microsoft Teams. You may recall I was complaining bitterly that it didn't want to install for personal use. It kept sending me to Skype. So I installed it as a business instead, and that worked fine. So I actually installed it on my desktop and on my laptop, and I ran a video conference quite successfully. And then we got to the main meeting, and what you see is what we saw at the main meeting. The presenter was talking and then gave a PowerPoint presentation. And I could tell that she'd gone to the PowerPoint presentation because the screen, instead of being dark gray mostly, it changed to what you see, which is a jet black background. Every time she went into PowerPoint, it was jet black. When she was talking, it was gray. All the little icons are really webcams, and you can see the only one that shows anything is mine. So I'm not impressed with Microsoft Teams. End of story. This is for you again, Chris.
Yeah, so there's been some talk about the COVID Alert app, and one of the discussion items that came up was whether people could game the system. The idea behind it being that people enter a code into the COVID Alert app if they've been diagnosed as being COVID-19 positive, and then if you're close to them for a period of time, then your phone will alert you to that, and you should get yourself checked out, presumably. Well, Michael Geis, who's a law professor at the University of Ottawa, and he's also a Canada Research Chair in Internet and E-commerce Law, he uses the app. And in Law Bites Podcast 63, he actually talked with the Ontario Privacy Commissioner about the app, and she uses it as well. And so from a privacy point of view, I don't think either of those people were concerned or anything like that, that, you know, there could be something bad about it. And, the other thing that was about it was that the way it actually works pretty much guarantees, I guess, that they won't be able to game the system. And the reason is that if you test COVID positive, then they will give you a unique ID that you can or can't, it's up to you, plug it into the COVID Alert app. So it is a unique ID, and when your phone detects that it's spent a certain amount of time, I think it's 15 minutes, within 2 meters of somebody, that you get their code, and your app will actually communicate to see whether it's a valid code or not, before alerting you that, you know, you may be at risk or whatever. So I think that the idea of it being gamed is probably pretty low from that perspective, at least. And according to the Google Play Store, the app has been installed over 500,000 times. So it may be getting to be useful. So that's all I had to say on that, just a little bit more information I found out about it.
Okay, Bob Walker here. I'm a retired senior IT project manager from the Public Health Agency of Canada, and my team developed some of the original contact tracking applications and outbreak management applications. This isn't really a contact tracking application because they've gone maybe a little bit too far overboard on the privacy part of things. It's more of an exposure tracing application. So you can get some idea that you might have been near somebody who might have exposed you to it, but it doesn't really track contacts that well because they've taken the privacy part of it a little bit too far. So how useful this app is going to be is, I guess, a little bit questionable.
Yeah, I tend to agree on that, but because it is so privacy, aimed at maintaining privacy and so forth. But I sort of figure, well, you know, if it increases the likelihood that you can tell if you were near somebody who's COVID positive by 2%, well, it's 2% that's free. You know, it's not like, you know, we have to have something that is anywhere near perfect. If it increases the ability for people to know that they should get tested, then why not? And it's totally voluntary all across the board. Putting it on your phone to detect it, putting it on your phone if you test COVID positive. It's your choice to put it onto your phone. I don't see it as being hugely effective, but if it's a little bit effective, why not?
Oh, it's Linda here. I mean, I don't think it was ever designed to be a contact tracing system. They have other ways of doing that, and it's just strictly an exposure app, I guess. And as Chris says, it's up to you how useful you make it. If you get a ping, it's up to you to go get tested. If somebody gets tested, it's up to them to put that code in. It does depend on the people using it, but that also protects everybody's privacy. And I don't think you'd get 500,000 downloads if they were starting to really use it for contact tracing. I just don't think you would. So
yeah, that's probably the case. Yeah, I agree with that.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Beyalt, I was wondering, would you have to leave your location on when you're at home? Could you just put it on as you leave the house, so to speak, so that you would only get pinged if you weren't at home?
Yeah, they actually talked about that in the Law Bites podcast, and that was one of the suggestions, was that you could turn it on and off at your convenience.
Right, yeah. So you don't get pinged in the middle of the night because somebody's roaming around.
I'm not sure the exact frequency that you actually get pinged and things like that. I don't think you need to be notified immediately when, you know, it's just sort of like, you know, I think it's in the last 48 hours you've been, you know, in close proximity to somebody for 15 minutes. And so I don't think they're going to be pinging you all day long, sort of thing. But I'm not sure the exact specifics behind that. But they did talk about that, the idea that you could turn it on and off at your convenience.
I kind of like a little bit of the philosophy behind it, because if I ever tested positive and had been in a doctor's office the day before or on a bus or on the train, I'd feel terrible that I didn't know I was infectious when I sat next to those people, and I would have no way of telling them. So this gives me a bit of relief.
Yeah, yeah. It's not a bad idea. Yeah.
Jocelyn's asking, you get the code when you are positive only.
Yeah. Yeah, when you're tested, they will give you a code and explain to you about the COVID Alert app. And then it's totally voluntary. They don't ask you if you're going to do it. It's totally up to you. You can install the app, put in the code, and then you will start alerting other people if they're in close proximity to you for 15 minutes or more.
If you get tested and you're positive, are you supposed to quarantine yourself?
I think they tell you to do that, yes. If you're but that's nothing to do with this app. I mean, it's just the, you know, that is the protocol. If you do test positive, I'm pretty sure they tell you that you should be quarantining yourself.
So you shouldn't be walking around.
No, but it's before you know you're positive. That's where this comes into play. Is you don't know, you haven't been tested, and
no,
then you go get tested. So once you're tested and you know you're positive, you don't go out in the bus and you don't go sit in the doctor's office. Of course, you're quarantined.
Well, but Linda, that's the thing, is you're not going to get the code to put into your phone until you've tested positive and you know it. And at that point, you shouldn't be wandering around.
That's what I'm saying. So this is to.
But you shouldn't be alerting anybody then either, right? Because you're at home.
And how long does it take before you're not positive?
The exposure has come before you know you're positive. So if you go on a bus, you have no idea you're sick, you end up getting tested, you're positive, this is the only way you can tell people, look, I didn't know I was sick. Now that I do know I'm sick, I'm quarantined, I'm at home. This is the only way I can tell you, you sat next to me when I had no idea I was infectious, so you might want to get tested. That's what it's for. Once you're sick, once they tell you you got COVID, you stay home, you're quarantined.
No, but the thing is, your phone can't alert other people once you're sitting at home.
Why not?
Because you haven't gotten the code until you tested positive. Then it goes into your phone, but your phone has no way of alerting anybody if you're following the rules.
Okay. Interesting. I thought you
hadn't thought about that.
Keep in mind you can be communicable for up to 5 or 6 days before you'll actually test positive.
Yeah, so, I mean, at that point, you haven't got a code in your phone, so.
Yeah.
So you're not alerting anybody. So, yeah, that's a good point. I wonder if anybody is going to get alerted if the person is actually following the rules and they are quarantining themselves. They shouldn't be actually alerting anybody. But I guess if they decide, well, I'm going to go out anyways, then they will be alerting other people. So.
Or they have somebody take their phone out and walk around wherever they were the week before.
The good news is we can all go to Bob Harris's for beer because he's got the app on his phone.
This is a good job for students. Go around and pretend you're that person with their phone once they've tested positive.
Yeah, I like that idea.
Well, if you've ever tasted Bob Harris's beer, it's sort of an antidote against COVID anyway.
I assume that if you are positive, that the government will also do tracing. So it's kind of an extra, but they are still doing the tracing. So if you have been through the bus or whatever, they will still try to warn people that you met, whether you have the application or not.
Yep.
So if you get tested positive, you're positive. How long does it take before you're negative, like that you recover when you stay home?
I think it's 2 weeks. Well, they say within 2 weeks you should be clear.
And then does it take you out of the database so it doesn't ping whenever you go anywhere?
I'm pretty sure that is the case, yeah.
Once you test positive, there are people that are suffering serious symptoms and in hospital for weeks at a time, and they found other people that have teenagers, young adults, whatever, that had what amounted to a very mild case of the flu. And they've been symptomatic for weeks afterwards. So they really haven't established a definite date from if you test positive. Here's how long it takes before you're safe to go out. And you have to keep on testing. And then after you finally test negative again, then maybe you're safe. But people come up with symptoms after symptoms, even after they've tested negative. So there's still a lot of unknowns in this area.
And there's a couple of comments in the queue here that it can take quite a bit longer than 14 days. Someone had it for 8 weeks, and Bob says the symptoms can last for many months or longer.
I believe the podcast talked a little bit about that aspect of how long the code stays in the system and things like that. So if you are interested, by all means, check out the Local Geist podcast.
Actually, the 2 weeks is not that if you are positive, you can stay positive for a very long time. You can die of it, obviously, but it depends how long it takes. But the 2 weeks is that if you are coming from an area that you may affected, in order to be sure that you are not infected, it takes 2 weeks. But it's if you have nothing. But if you have if you have something, then it can take a lot longer than the 2 weeks. It's just that once you think you have nothing, it takes 2 weeks to be sure that you really have nothing.
Okay, I think we should move on. We spent a lot of time on this.
I'm sure once you test positive, they'll be after you to do a retest when they need to. So.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving along, this is a share from Eldon Gore. And he found a website that tells you how to disable the caps lock key. So if you're hitting the caps lock key by mistake and can't enter your password properly, for example, and you can't do it in Windows directly. They don't have a setting to disable the key. What you have to do is remap it. And one of the ways to do it is remap it to a key that doesn't exist. And that will, in fact, disable it. So there are a couple of ways to do it. And of course, one of the ways is to edit the registry, which is always fraught with difficulties. And you have to locate this key and then change the binary code for the scan code map. And the article gives the scan code. And there are two key pieces of the data there. The blue text is the 3A00. That says, I want you to remap the caps lock key. And then the orange 0000 says, that's what I want you to remap it to. In other words, remap it to nothing. So that's how to disable the key. Another way to do it is to use a utility program to do the editing for you. And the advantages of doing that are that typically these utilities will do lots of keyboard mapping. So you can remap all kinds of different keys. And clearly it makes it very easy rather than having to edit the registry. And it's typically a one-shot deal. You run the program, you change the key, and you're done. A couple of options to do this. One's called Sharp Keys. And Chris had talked about Microsoft Power Toys. And it has a keyboard manager built into it, and I'll let him talk about that.
Yeah, the biggest thing, the difference between Sharp Keys and Power Toys is that Sharp Keys is one key only. So you can map, you know, F12 to whatever you want, to W if you want it. Or you can map, you know, the left shift key to be M or whatever you want. But it's one key to one key mapping. So it works. You just pick out the keystroke that you actually want on there and what you want to map it to. And you're done. It will actually do that change in the registry for you, and nothing has to continue running on your computer. It just does it, and then it's good. You're good to go.
And it gives you that option of turn the key off.
Yeah, turn the key off is just, yeah, basically disable the key rather than mapping it to another key. So if you want to be able to do more than just a key, one key, so you want to do Control-C, or something like that, you can use Power Toys. The disadvantage is that you have to have it running all the time, but there are a lot of Power Toys that are useful, and so I don't find it a problem to have Power Toys always running. And you can map multiple keys. So things like the caps lock key, you could do Win and the 2 key. So that would load the second icon on your system tray that is pinned to the tray. Or you could do Control-Alt-B map to Control-Shift-M or various things like that. So it allows you to do that multiple key mapping, which is really a lot of extra flexibility. The other thing it can let you do is map a key only for a particular program. So an example that was given by the Power Toys people was that, well, Outlook, the find key in Outlook is F4. Well, a lot of people don't remember that F4 is the find, and it's only the find in Outlook. So what you could do is map Control-F to F4 so that when you're in Outlook, you just hit Control-F and it'll do the find for you. So, again, you have to keep Power Toys running all the time, but it is more flexible in terms of what mappings it can actually do. And so if you're interested in Power Toys overall, it's no pain to have it available to do the keyboard mapping as well.
And just a comment here. Over the years, I've had several desktop and laptop computers where the caps lock key has a little LED in it that tells you that it's enabled. I mean, why has everybody seemed to have stopped doing that? It's like the hard drive activity indicator and your internet activity indicator lights at the bottom of your screen. It seems everybody has decided to stop using those.
Yeah. Usually you have a caps lock key or light over towards the right above the numeric keypad. You'll often have it. But, yeah, I agree with you that the idea of having a light right on the caps lock key would be a useful thing.
Okay. On this HBMV.
Sorry.
You're just saying this HBMV has got a itsy-bitsy tiny light on the top right-hand corner of the cap lock key, which I occasionally notice.
Next question belies Chris's experience with sound earlier on. I noticed previously that Chris's sound is the most clear and crisp of it all. So what kind of headset or microphone is he using, and what device is being used to get that quality? I suspect it's not little dog there, right?
Yeah, personally, I think that one of the biggest differences that you can make in terms of sound quality is to get away from a microphone that is like 2 or 3 feet away from you. And so using a headset, I think, is the biggest thing that you can actually do. The other thing about having a microphone that is really close to your mouth is that it's less likely to treat ambient noise with the same volume as, or the same weight as your voice. Because it's very much closer to you. So it'll end up giving you a little bit more likelihood that it'll treat your voice special and give more volume to that. So I think that's the biggest thing. The other thing that I think can happen when you have sound devices in a laptop is that there is a possibility that the microphone will pick up sound from the speaker of the device and could produce some feedback or echo. Really bad cases, you can get it screeching at you. Personally, I think that any headset will probably give you great sound, certainly a lot better than a 2 foot away or 3 foot away microphone built into a laptop screen. I like the ones like you see on the screen where it has a single ear pad, and that way I can still hear other sounds that are around me, so I feel a little bit less isolated. You know, if somebody was to call out to me or something like that, I'm going to hear it a little bit more easily. Because I'm using that boom microphone, even if somebody calls out from a distance, it's less likely to be picked up by the microphone. I posted into the chat window there. This is the one that I actually have. It is now currently unavailable, but I found one at Amazon Canada that looks identical, except it doesn't have Colez on the side of it. It has some other brand name. But everything else about it looks absolutely identical, and it is available at a pretty decent price. It was $38 on sale. They have a $4 off coupon, but be careful with that, because if you get $4 off, it brings you down to $34, and free shipping is $35 and above. So Amazon gives you a $4 coupon in the aim to get you to buy more stuff so that you get free shipping. So you might find it better to just do the $38 without the free coupon, but that's not a bad price for a headset, $38 or $34 if you're buying some other things. And if you're interested in that, the link is in the chat.
And if you have Amazon Prime, the shipping is free anyway.
True. Yep. I'm a cheap SOB. I don't pay for Amazon Prime.
Okay, the next question is from somebody who's changing service providers. They've been using the email address provided by the ISP, and they're thinking of switching to an address that isn't tied to their new provider, because then they'd have to switch every time they change ISPs. Thinking of going with Gmail or Outlook.com, looking for advice on the easiest method of switching to this new email address. So, Christopher.
Yeah, there's no easy button. I like the idea of keeping your old address live as long as you can. And what my approach is on when doing something like this is you just start telling all your people in your address book to start using your new email address. You go through all of those services that you have signed up for and so forth on the web, that you've given them your email address, and if you want them to still be able to contact you, you go and update them. And by keeping both addresses alive for as long as possible, maybe as much as a year, you'll watch as, you know, the traffic on the old address starts to drop down. And then anytime you get something, you go, oh, there's somebody else I have to notify. And I figure after a year, you probably actually have all of the people that you want to be able to contact you should have tried to contact you at least once and given you the option of giving them a new address to communicate with you. But, yeah, I don't think there's an easy button.
I have a question about that. I changed addresses. People removed the old address from their contact list. However, when they put my name in, if they weren't responding to me and they just started typing my name, the system they were using or whatever, it had like this autofill that kept this memory. And so even though it was removed from their actual address book, it came up and they were sending things to my old address.
This can happen a lot with Outlook. Outlook has an autofill capability, and it's a separate file that maintains this recently used addresses or whatever. And as you type it in, it pops up. If you hover your, like if you just cursor over top of it, you can hit the delete key and you can remove it. You can actually remove that, the entire file. It's a NIK file or NK2 file, I think is the file. It's a nickname file is what they name it. If you're interested, email me. I can give you the information about where it is and what it's called. But yeah, it's a problem, and it's typically with Outlook. I don't know if any other email clients actually do the similar thing. No easy solution.
Yeah, they were not using Outlook.
Okay. So yeah, in that case, it'll be whatever their client is using, whatever mail client they're using, that they have to find some way to delete it. Now, if it is sort of coming up as a pop-up, I would suggest they try, because when it pops up, arrow down to it and hit the delete key, or maybe right-click on it. You might get an option to delete it. But outside of that, I don't know any way of dealing with that.
You might find you might want to get away from Outlook entirely, because it is sort of problematic and locks you into things. And you might be happier with Google or Hotmail or any one of a number of other free services.
If you've used your email address as your ID when you have set up accounts and you no longer have that email address, but they often ask you for your email as well. Can you use your old email, defunct, non-existent email address still as an ID? Or do you have to change?
You shouldn't have a problem with that, because what it's using is it's just a unique identifier. And that's why a lot of places have gone to an email address, because they know that it will be unique worldwide. And so that's why they use it. But it is just that. It's a unique identifier. It isn't really tied to your email unless they use that as the only way to contact you, in which case at that point you would have to change it as your login ID as well as your contact info.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Okay, so moving on, the next one. Marbell sending warnings about going over the data limit. What activities cause the use of data? I thought I could do anything free with Wi-Fi. And then a list of activities. What causes data usage? Zoom, streaming videos, YouTube, internet links, emails with or without photos, attachments, and internet access, etc. So when we have a data cap on an account, it's basically limiting the amount of data that can be transferred via that user's account over a specific time period. And it's usually so many gigabytes, let's say, per month. The level of the actual cap, if you have one, and the associated overage charges, if you go over that data limit, will be specified by the user agreement, and you have to look that up for your particular service. And data caps can be on both home internet service and mobile data, which would be your smartphone plan, for example. Now, all the things that were listed there connect some kind of connection to the internet, and so they use data. And data just means information that's being transferred. So it can be text, it can be graphics, it can be videos, and it's coming from anywhere on the internet. Whether you have free Wi-Fi or not basically depends on your plan. And it's really your plan with your home internet service provider. If you have an unlimited account, you basically get free Wi-Fi. And you can also get free Wi-Fi at public hotspots like McDonald's and Tim Hortons and Starbucks. If you have a...
Oh, sorry, Alan, I unshared your screen, sorry. I thought the annotations going on the screen where I could stop that, but sorry. Okay.
Okay, my slide disappeared on me. So if you have an unlimited home internet service, you can make connections to the internet on computers and tablets, and there can't be any overage charges because it's an unlimited service. And the same would go for connecting to the internet on your smartphone when you're connecting it at home, because you're using your unlimited ISP at home, or if you have a public hotspot, as we said, like Starbucks. However, on your smartphone, if you enable data, then you get charges applying to all data that's transferred over the air. And smartphones can cost you money in all kinds of different ways. First of all, when you make a phone call or somebody calls you, you're subject to a per-minute charge for airtime. But most plans will give you a certain number of free minutes, 50, 100 minutes a month, let's say. Or it can be unlimited. Again, it all depends on your plan. Outgoing text messages are usually billed. Incoming text messages are usually free. But outgoing text messages, it's usually 20 cents per message or something like that. With a certain number of messages, or it could be unlimited messages each month, which would be free. And then for internet access, you'll be billed as the amount of data which you download, and that usually is subject to a data cap. So when you buy a phone plan, you can get so many minutes, so many text messages, and a certain amount of gigabytes of data. And the other thing you've got to watch for on phones is if it goes into roaming mode, and especially if you get down near the American border. And if you're sitting on the Canadian side, your phone may connect to a cell tower on the American side, and suddenly you'll be roaming and subject to all kinds of charges. And if you go to a foreign country, the phone always welcomes you to that country because they want to crank up money on your roaming charges. So that's why you have airplane mode to turn that off. Anybody have any other comments on all of the above?
Yeah, just a note. You have a setting on your smartphone, because I'm down near the American border or on the other side fairly often up until this COVID thing happened, and you can put a setting on your most smartphones where it only accepts service when you're connected to your home network. So if I'm connected to Bell or Virgin or Rogers or whatever, and I cross at Ogdensburg, or I'm still on the Canadian side driving down the 401, you can have it reject any connections from any American networks.
Yeah, that may be phone specific, Bob. Or carrier specific.
Well, I got that piece of advice from Rob Cross, who's an iPhone user, and I'm a Samsung guy, so it seems to work both ways. So,
well, that's good, because the next question is for you then, Bob. It says, how do I turn off data on a Samsung phone?
Well, I haven't turned off data, but I've got mine set to use Wi-Fi wherever possible, and for the most part, I use when I'm doing data use, I'm at home on my own Wi-Fi network, or at something like my car dealer waiting for my car to be serviced, and on their Wi-Fi network or whatever. So. I got a super deal on a data plan from Virgin Mobile as part of one of their deals a couple of years ago, and I've never come anywhere remotely close to using all my data, so it's not something I particularly worry about. And on the phone, you should be able to set, you know, notify me when I'm up to X percentage of my data allowable data usage, so that if you are getting close to anything, to going over the limit, your phone gives you a warning and says, well, I'm almost over my limit and there's 2 weeks left to go in the month. You might want to consider being a bit more careful, but in general, you should be able to set warnings or use Wi-Fi to avoid most of the data usage.
Yeah.
That said, I've had a couple problems with Zoom connectivity in the past couple months, and I've had to use my cell phone to connect with a Zoom meeting, including this morning with another Zoom meeting I had. So
I think in general, it's good to kind of check out the controls that are in the settings, because that's where you'll find this thing. But as I said, I think all phones and some carriers are different. For this particular question on the Samsung phone, if you look on the website, you may find the answer for your particular model. In general, this screenshot here is the settings screen, and you can see there's a mobile data toggle. You just slide that switch to the left, and it turns data off. But as Bob says, you can also set, on some phones anyway, you can set limits on a warning when you're getting close to your data cap.
Hey, your screenshot, so you've got that. You've got a 2 gigabyte data warning at the top there.
Yeah.
Up here there's a 2 gigabyte data warning. So that would kick in a message if there was a problem.
This is a good idea when you get a new smartphone to sort of go through all the different settings that are possible. Go through the settings menus and drill down on each particular settings to see what your options are. For example, my wife Cindy had a Samsung Note 4 for a few years. She was very happy with it. And then the thing finally died. And it was going to cost like $1,400 for a Note 10. So we ended up getting a different brand of phone for her. And, of course, everything works differently. And Cindy's not a technical person, so she has a little bit more trouble adapting to this than maybe I would have. But it's a good idea when you get a new phone to just go through all the different settings. And if you don't quite understand it, get on the Internet there and try and figure things out. Especially on YouTube, you can get a lot of instructional videos and all that on various models of phones to help you adapt to it a lot better. Even if you're using a newer model of the phone you had last year, it can be very helpful.
Okay, this is going to be the last question. We're getting close to our time. Bernie's using Outlook 2013 and suddenly can't get his contact list. And if he looks under My Contacts, he gets two lists. This computer only, which has nothing in it, and Contacts, which has got all the data, but this one doesn't do anything when he's hitting two on a new message. So does anybody have any suggestions how to remedy that? You have to mute yourself to answer.
Yeah, I have. Let me do a share screen. And let me bring up, so this is Outlook 2019, but it should be the same in all versions of Outlook. The first thing I would check is that you see here, you click on Address Book on the Home tab in Outlook. It will bring up your address book. And then if you go on to the Tools and Options, this has where it's going to look for address lists. So a global address list is something that is used with people that have an exchange server. So it's corporation and things like that. You're not going to have a global address list in a home setting. So what you will see in here, you probably will see two contact folders, okay? Because
Chris,
that's
you sharing the screen. Sorry. I don't think you were sharing your screen.
Did I not? Oh, sorry.
And make sure you're not sharing your emails.
Okay. There, is that better?
Yes.
Okay, let me go back. Ding, 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 ding. Okay, so on the main screen, click on the Home tab over there, and then click on Address Book. And then in the Address Book, you can go to Tools, Options. You won't have a global address list, but you will have probably, from what the question came in, you'll have two lists down in the main box of contacts. So you can actually come down into custom, and then it'll have any address books that you have listed there, and you can change the order for them. And then it will actually look to those contact folders in that order in order to look for contacts. Now, the fact that it was finding none, usually it will look through all of them, if that's just the order that they will look through them all. So if you're only seeing one there and it's the contact folder that's empty, the what you have to do then is if you come back to your Outlook panel on the left-hand side, if you go to the dot, dot, dot and go to folders, you'll probably see here that you will have two contact folders. Okay, from what your description as it came in, there were two contact folders. One was empty and one wasn't. So if I click on this one here, I don't have any of the contacts in there. So that would not be the one that I'd be interested in. I'd be interested in the other one. So find the one that has your contacts and then right-click on where it says contacts, go to properties, and then in Outlook address book, this might be unselected, so show this address book as an email show this folder as an email address book. Maybe that's been deselected for some reason. Right now, this is just an empty Outlook, and so I only have the one, so I can't deselect it. But what you might have is that your other contact folder is not showing up as an address book. If you check that box, then they should both show up. And then, if you wanted to, you can go back to the address book, and you could actually change the order of it or whatever you want. But if you come into options, they should both be showing there. You could change the order, but it doesn't really matter. It'll actually look to both contact folders at that point in time. Clear as mud?
Well, that's good.
Okay.
So we're just over the 8:30, so I guess if anybody has any burning questions, comments, or things that they want to share, unmute yourself and say something. Did I share my screen? No, I didn't. There we go.
Okay, in the Q&A or in the chat, there's somebody posted a little bit more information about exactly how the COVID Alert app works. Natalie said that Bell is unlimited until the end of October because of COVID. So that's kind of cool. You get unlimited bandwidth. With Bell Internet, you can check daily Internet usage and where it's from. So, yeah, most of the ISPs will give you the ability to go online and check what your usage has been. I don't think most of them will actually say where it's from, but anyway, that's kind of neat. And Bob Harris says he checks his Bell usage carefully, especially towards the end of the monthly term. Reset the data on the phone on my renewal day every month, so constantly know my usage. The Bell usage is 4 hours old, so it takes a little bit of time for the information to percolate through to you. That's all we have currently in the chat. Is there anything anybody else has for chat or want to unmute yourself?
Just thanks for the explanation of the Outlook.
Okay. Bernie, if you need to, reach out to me, and I can give you that in step-by-step in an email.
Okay, I'll try it after the Q&A.
I'm pretty sure one of those is going to fix it for you.
Okay.
Yeah, and the deck will be up on their website shortly, so.
But the sharing of that information is in the deck.
No. Okay. All right. Well, we're 8:35, so we're over an hour. Just a note for next week. You recall that somebody was asking for a demo of Google Docs, and I was asking if anybody wanted to volunteer. I'm pleased to report that Jocelyn will demonstrate Google Docs next week. So if you have any burning questions about Google Docs, then all will be revealed by Jocelyn Dwyer next week. I'm sure all is going to be revealed, right, Jocelyn? Sure. So if you have any other questions, if you have any answers to the questions that get posted or topics that you want to share with other people, here is our email address. Thank you all for attending. And good night to me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. It was very helpful.
Thanks for attending, folks.
Thank you.
See you all next week.
That's a weird hum we've got in the background there, Alan. Do you know where that's coming from?
No.
It's down to just four of us. Only two of us are active mics, so I wonder if it's because I turned up the gain so much on my microphone.
Turn mine off, see what happens.
Yeah. Well, seems to have gone away, so I guess it was you. Oh, maybe not.
I do hear a slight hum, but
yeah,
I think it's my hard drive or
okay.
Fan and a laptop,
wasn't it? Oh, well. Wasn't too annoying anyway, so that's fine. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks much. Talk to you later.
Bye now.
Bye.